Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Our topic today is our bodies, in particular, diet and exercise. Consider these recent headlines from, in sequence, the New York Times, Vox, and the Washington Post. Quote, why you can't lose weight on a diet. Quote, why you shouldn't exercise to lose weight, explained with 60-plus studies. Quote, more exercise doesn't always mean losing weight. So today we're asking, if not to lose weight, why exercise? What health benefits follow from working out? How much exercise do we need and what type? Just half of American adults meet the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines for aerobic physical activity. That is 150 minutes a week of moderate cardiorespiratory activities such as walking, swimming, or biking, 2.5 hours a week. Only one in five adults meets the guidelines for both aerobic and muscle strengthening activity. As a group, we don't seem eager to exercise. Joining me in Studio A is Joe Zimmerman, physical activity program coordinator and lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. Joe Zimmerman earned her undergraduate and master's degree from George Mason University and holds a variety of credentials in strength and conditioning. She's been working in the health and fitness industry for more than 25 years, including a long career as a personal trainer. Welcome to Midday, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
So I have the impression that the emphasis of health and medical experts is shifting, that the talk today is more about exercise and less about restricting calories. Am I right about that?
I think the emphasis is to help get the people who are not exercising to begin exercising and to take action, whether through diet or through exercise or some combination. We don't want to dissuade anyone who's already active to do less. And certainly there's not a lot of people who are regularly active who need to do a whole lot more unless they're training for a goal. But the honest truth is that the majority of us do not get enough physical activity for health reasons or for fitness reasons. And I make that distinction on purpose.
Okay. Explain that to me, because I tend to think of health and fitness in the same phrase.
Yeah. So I think we as Americans tend to think all or nothing. We're really good at that. And I think that's what stops people sometimes. So when you're exercising for health reasons, let's say you want to reduce your blood pressure, or you want to help regulate your blood sugar, or you want to help keep your joints loose because you're starting to feel some of the creeping effects of normal aging, you don't need a lot of exercise to do that. In fact, you can take this recommendation of 150 minutes and break it up into 10-minute chunks. You might not even break a sweat. So that starts to take some of the inconvenience factor out of it.
Really? I thought to be serious, and I wasn't ever thinking of, you know, Olympic type serious. I meant just to count as a push to your cardiovascular system. You needed to break a sweat.
Well, it depends on where you're starting. So that's what I mean. The people who are already active, these are not the people we're as worried about. We are very worried about the people who are not active at all. So if someone who's truly sedentary wants to begin and they jump into a fantastic group exercise class, or they decide to go train for a marathon, they may start with too much of a very good thing. I'm a big fan of people starting at the beginning with basic walking or whatever it is they're capable of doing.
You said a minute ago you could break it up into, I think you said
ten minute chunks.
Let me ask the reverse question. Mm-hmm. If my goal is 2.5 hours of moderate moving a week, do I need to do a bit of that every day, or can I sort of, you know, do an hour when I have time? A lot of people do more on the weekends.
There are benefits to doing the bigger chunks, certainly. But again, if we're thinking about beginners or re-beginners, having those little pieces as opportunities to add physical activity through the day without having to change clothes and all of that, get some people moving. But the big chunks are also useful. But doing it all 2.5 hours in one day doesn't gain the benefits that make up for the sedentary behavior the rest of the week. It is better to get a bit nearly every day.
And these bits that you're talking about, these 10-minute bits, what are you envisioning?
Walking.
Just
or not power walking, just
no, just get off
walking
the couch.
Down the street. Just
get out of your office. I use the water fountain at the other end of the building, not because the one near me doesn't work, but because that makes me walk 100 yards or whatever. I don't exactly know how big the building is. I'm not one that's going to park at the wrong end of the parking lot, you know, and, you know, I understand people have to take safety decisions and things like that. But those are the ways you can sneak in a little bit of activity. I almost never take the elevator. I try to always take the stairs, and I'm able to still do that both directions. I know people with knee problems may have to take a different decision. But there are ways to sneak in little pieces. Because I teach on a university campus, I walk to my own classes. I don't have a scooter or anything like that. I don't drive even when I have way across campus. So my environment allows me to do that. Not everybody's does, but think about the amount of time we spend. We sit down and we watch the news, and then we sit down and we watch Jeopardy or whatever, and then we watch one of the dramas, and then maybe we're sitting and helping a family member with homework. We've been on our rear end for 8 hours at work. Then we've got half an hour commute each day. There's 10 hours on our rear end. And then we've got 3 hours in the evening on our rear end. We need to give our rear ends a break.
I laugh, but I have been reading a lot about the concerns about people being sedentary. So even if you look at your pattern of activity and say, hey, I'm getting 2.5 hours a week easily of moderate exercise, I still have to worry about being sedentary between the exercise.
Yeah, and that's what's really new in some of the research is that there is this saying, I'm sorry, I've forgotten who coined the phrase, but that sitting is the new smoking.
I've heard that phrase too.
Yeah, and so, you know, you might be one of the remarkable marathon training people who does a lot of running for half an hour, 45 minutes in the morning, but then you are a desk jockey for 8 or 10 hours. Is it better to have run? Oh, my goodness, yes. But you are largely sedentary. It would be better to have, you know, break that big block of sedentary behavior up and go walk to a friend's office and have lunch somewhere or anything. Just break up the blocks.
That is Jo Zimmerman here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She is a former personal trainer. She is program physical activity program coordinator and lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. And we're talking about exercise and why it's valuable, even if it has nothing to do with weight loss. And it does probably have something to do with weight loss. What are your thoughts about this? How do you make room in your life for exercise? Do you try to fit workouts in the morning, evenings, during the day? We'd like to hear what works for you. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So if we remove weight loss from the equation, what do you tell people are the benefits of exercise? What is it we're going to get out of these short breaks?
One of the major benefits of the short breaks is that they help sort of clear your head and clear the lethargy of the day. Some of us will sort of be, you know, sitting at the desk and getting in kind of a rut, and we're sort of creeping over and turning into curved, excuse me very much, these sort of curved shape with terrible posture. And it starts to remodel our bodies over time. I mean, it's very uncomfortable. And by the time you stand up at the end of the day, you can't even really stand up. So taking little breaks helps jostle your body, helps jostle your mind, and it can raise your energy level a little tiny bit. It might allow someone the ability to sort of mentally reset. Rather than picking up the phone or popping off an email, you walk down to your office colleague and ask the question directly. That makes you move for a moment. But in the process of walking, you might actually stimulate your own brain to solve the problem before you get there.
I want to read a paragraph from one of the Washington Post articles on this general topic. This was called... this was headlined, "We All Know Exercise Makes You Live Longer, But This Will Actually Get You Off the Couch." And this was how it summarized just some of the physical benefits. Exercise lowers blood pressure. It makes the body more sensitive to the action of insulin, which lowers blood glucose. It makes platelets, the mini cells that trigger clots in strokes and heart attacks, less sticky and increases the amount of clot-dissolving enzyme in the blood. It reduces some markers of body-wide inflammation, such as C-reactive protein. It slows the accumulation of calcium in arterial walls, a risk factor for heart attack. It increases the nitric oxide made by arteries, which allows them to expand and carry more blood when circumstances demand. Exercise also lowers the resting heart rate, which benefits the heart over the long run. What is it about exercise that does all this?
We have lots and lots of answers, and some of them are incredibly technical. But if you think about your heart as a pump and your blood vessels as plumbing, when you're using the system, when you're challenging the system, you have your heart rate come up, and it pushes blood into your blood vessels, and they have to be flexible to absorb that increase. And that flexibility has value for when we aren't doing something planned. There's some emergency, or you get stressed out or something. That's called vascular compliance. And when you lose compliance, some of that happens naturally with age. Some of it happens as part of disease processes like hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis. That compliance is diminished. It's preserved with exercise. By running the system more vigorously, we preserve the function of the system to run more vigorously. We can use it any time.
Okay, but that's why it's
the blood pressure. That's the platelets. That's all of those things.
But that's also why I have to think twice to see whether I really believe you when you say that just walking is enough to stress the system that way and create those benefits. That's why I think a lot of us think it needs to be sweaty. It needs to be extended. It needs to be hard.
Walking is better than nothing, certainly, for almost anyone. For someone who's in good shape, for someone who ordinarily would run, walking isn't going to be enough to stimulate the system to continue to improve. It will be enough to maintain what's there. So when someone who is a regular exerciser, even an athlete, for example, has a bad cold, they're not going to go for a hard run, or they're not going to go do whatever it is they ordinarily do, but they might go for a walk.
And that will maintain.
It'll help. It'll bridge the gap. But most of us are not superior athletes.
Right.
Most of us are couch potatoes. We need to start at the beginning and work our way up. And a walk or some such gentle thing is enough to get going, and it's a good place to start for nearly anyone. It might be just the warm-up for someone.
Couch potatoes. We need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Joe Zimmerman, instructor at the University of Maryland's Department of Kinesiology, about the benefits of exercise. We'd love you to be part of this conversation. Have you recently taken up some kind of exercise? Yoga, hiking, Zumba? Why? What type of exercise do you enjoy? Solitary activities or social ones? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. A survey last year by the Physical Activity Council found that more than 80 million Americans age 6 and over, that's about one-third of the U.S. population, are totally sedentary. These individuals did not participate in any of the 104 physical activities listed by the survey, activities like running, jogging, baseball, basketball, football, yoga, or weightlifting. Between 2007 and 2014, the annual survey showed an 18% increase in those labeled totally sedentary. Today, we're talking about the merits of moving, the benefits of exercise beyond weight loss, with Joe Zimmerman, lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. What is your relationship to exercise? Do you feel better when you're moving? Do you notice a difference? In what ways? Call us at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wypr.org. one of the things, picking up on what we were talking about, piecing exercise in sort of where you can make time for it, one of the goals that people talk about sometimes is 10,000 steps. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, first of all, that means wearing a pedometer to even know how many steps you're taking, but does that work?
It might be too much for a lot of people to start with, but part of that came out of the idea of aligning the physical activity recommendations with different ways people can understand them. So we say 150 minutes a week, and some people are going, "Oh, I can't possibly do that," and they don't understand that they can break it up into little pieces. Or they want to see something like walking X amount of distance or the 10,000 steps. If you sort of cross map 10,000 steps with 1,500 calories a week with the 150 minutes a week of moderate physical activity, it should work out to about the same total amount of effort for a given person. So for someone who maybe does not live near a fitness facility, or it isn't conducive in their neighborhood to be outdoors a whole lot for some reason, maybe climate or safety reasons, you could do other things. If you count total steps, you're probably going to get enough total physical activity. A lot of us don't get to put a whole lot of walking in our jobs because we have to be at a desk for an extended period of time. So that would allow someone to track then the walk before work, the walk before and after lunch, or as part of the lunch break. Sometime after work, it might help count what you're doing walking a dog if you've got a family dog. That kind of thing, where you can start to add little bits to accumulate. Now, the 10,000 steps reflects approximately 5 miles, depending on how tall you are and how long your stride is. 10,000 steps for me isn't quite 5 miles because I'm a little on the shorter side and I walk like Fred Flintstone. but it works out for energy consumption for me.
And it's a way of not just relying on your own estimate of I must have walked a half mile getting to the store when maybe it was only a quarter mile.
And I wear a Fitbit, so I do track it, and I have found that my activity is amazingly stable.
And since you raised that, I was planning to ask you later about fitness trackers and apps on phones, Fitbit, Jawbone. I gather you think it's useful if you're wearing one. What kind of advice do you give people about those kinds of apps and
I think
devices?
You find one that works for you, that's affordable, that allows you to do the activities you want. My Fitbit the one that I have is not water safe, so I can't wear it if I go swimming. But for what I use it for, I find it to be accurate for my behaviors. And I've been using it for a couple of years, and I really am incredibly consistent with my physical activity. I watch my steps across weeks and months and years, and I can see when it's winter by looking at the graph, not by looking at the months. I'm less active in the winter. I'm more active in the summer. I peg my meter when I go to my annual conference because I'm out of my office and I'm walking to the conference hall.
So,
up and down the stairs for
so
a
what
week.
Is what is the benefit to you then to wearing a Fitbit if you're looking and saying, yep, that's me,
well,
I do that. I mean, why wear it?
Because I'm so consistent, every now and then I can dip below and it's like, oh, come on, Zimmerman, get off the couch. Or, hey, I made a bigger impact today. And then the temptation is to reward myself. And I, you know, if I reward myself with, you know, a new shirt, that's fine. But the temptation is to reward yourself with a piece of pie or something, and you have to kind of discipline yourself to do, if depending on your goal.
But it's good. It's good feedback. Colin has called us from Baltimore. Colin, welcome to Midday.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
How you doing? Big fan of the show. I really like this topic. I just wanted to bring up that I agree with the talker today about just simply walking. Like, I think that is such a good point, and I wanted to just bring up a quick story about my aunt who, she's been struggling with weight problems for 10-15 years or so, and then a while back she got into doing marathons and working out, strenuous activity. In the process of doing these marathons, she had to get both of her knees replaced. for whatever reason, she couldn't handle the activity. So I just wanted to say that now she kind of found out the hard way that, you know, you should ease into things, I guess. You know, start out with walking rather than hitting these marathons and not knowing what your body can take. So I just wanted to, I feel like that is probably a pretty common story, and I just wanted to raise that fact.
I appreciate your calling. It seems to me Colin raises a couple of points. One is he mentioned that his aunt had struggled with weight problems. Mm-hmm. I gather that the thinking now is trying to address that with a heavy dose of exercise. It wasn't realistic to begin with.
That's a really interesting, fresh debate. And it's interesting also that we keep coming back, oh, it's diet. Oh, it's exercise. Oh, it's diet. Oh, it's probably both. But here, when I teach my class at University of Maryland, here's how I break it down. Even the most ardent exercise enthusiast, barring training athletes who do two-a-days, anybody who's really pretty serious about exercise might do it daily, 7 times a week. But even the most informal eater probably eats 21 to 28 times a week. You have a lot of opportunities to make small changes with food habits and food behaviors. I almost hate to use the word diet because it often means making an inappropriate change or deprivation. So I, food management, dietary management, things like that. So if I slip, don't hold it against me. But if you come at it from both sides, for most people, we don't, it's not easy for us to cut a big chunk of calories out without cutting too far into the nutrition that we need every day and just flat out feeling deprived and then triggering a binge or the wrong end of the behavior. So I think coming at it from some exercise and some dietary management probably is the best approach. And the research out there says that we need to do both. We need to do exercise for health. It's maybe not the miracle pill for weight loss, but it's still a really good idea, and it will burn some calories. I'm sorry about Colin's aunt, by the way, but I hope she's swimming or riding a bike in her beautiful bionic knees.
And Colin said she's trying to work in exercise in small time periods, which you have talked about. But if we're talking about those small time periods, and if we're talking about something like 2.5 hours a week stretched out over the week, and we've talked about, just sort of general benefits, the physical benefits of such exercise, but that's not really going to get your metabolism into high gear to lose a lot of weight, right? I mean, you really do need to address the intake side of calories.
One of the biggest problems is that we use the word metabolism badly. Metabolism gets used to describe effort, if you will. Our metabolism is really how much, if you think about it from a precise point of view, we usually will talk about resting or basal metabolism rate. And this is the amount of energy it takes to run our bodies, to grow some skin and to have thoughts and to do things, just sitting around, keeping ourselves warm. That number is pretty consistent across, not perfectly consistent, but once we're an adult, it stays pretty stable and declines a little bit from adulthood 2025 through our 60s and 70s. It drops off a little bit, but not as much as people want to claim. Pretty stable amount of energy to run and maintain your body. We have then, on top of that, this business about when we eat, it takes energy to chew and digest the food. And that's called thermic effect of feeding. That's a really romantic sounding phrase. But it takes energy to process the energy. So that's another piece of our total energy expenditure for a day. So run our body and then energy from food. And then we have our physical activity. And our physical activity in some of the recent articles have been claimed, it's a tiny portion. It's only 10 to 30%. Shoot, if I got a 10 to 30% raise.
You'd be happy.
Oh, yeah. 10 to 30% more space in my apartment. Heck yeah. 10 to 30% is not inconsequential, and it's 100% under our control.
And it's really the only part of the calorie expenditure that is under our control.
Yeah, it is. We can't, You can't really alter how your gut processes food, not dramatically, not without extraordinary circumstances like a gastric bypass. And you can't remarkably change your resting metabolism in spite of all this business about jack yourself up with this substance or zap your metabolism with the, you know, the 4-minute high program of whatever. That's malarkey.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Joe Zimmerman, lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. We're talking about exercise and weight loss, and you can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Vita has called us from Owings Mills. Vita, welcome to Midday.
Oh, hi! Thanks for taking my call, and nice program. I just want to make a comment about the recent activity that I picked up in the past 6 months. It's called Kriya Yoga.
I missed the adjective. What kind of yoga?
Kriya Yoga.
Uh-huh.
I can spell that out. That is Kriya.
And what is it about this yoga that's different than others?
Most of the yogas are purely stretches, body stretching, but this yoga is not purely, it has one stretch, but then most of them are breathing. So complete breathing, you know, 7 chakras in the body, they talk about, so we breathe on every chakras on the body. So this activity I picked up, one thing, the change in my schedule was, I started waking up early, like around 4:50 in the morning. I used to be like 7:30 person, but now I am 4:50. And I know that this Kriya Yoga takes exactly about 50 minutes for me. And pretty much whoever got this technique from their gurus, they round about, I think, 30 to 50 minutes. So...
Vita, I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. Joe Zimmerman, I have a very different experience of, I think it's Vinyasa Yoga that I do, and I think of it as quite a bit of strength and probably not that much focus on breathing. What do you tell people about yoga?
I think yoga is a terrific practice overall. The way Americans do yoga typically, and with no disrespect, typically is less of the spiritual component, but not necessarily eliminated. But we are more interested in the physical side of this. So my experience of yoga and the way we often have it in our classes and the way in the health club where I used to work, more about the breathing as part of the meditation and about personal control. You know, when you are trying to breathe very deeply, it has a very specific relaxation benefit. Breathing in speeds up your heart rate. Holding your breath briefly allows your heart rate to slow down, and a slow exhale slows it further. This can be an excellent way to begin to learn to meditate or to learn to self-hypnotize for pain control or for mood regulation. And then you couple that with what is very often additional breathing exercises or then perhaps the customary asanas, which are the posing positions that are associated often with yoga. And that can be good for the physical side as well.
And would you count that as part of the 150 minutes of moderate exercise that
most of the time,
the
no,
you
because
would
it
not.
Probably doesn't raise your heart rate. Now, we do have forms of yoga in this country because this is just kind of how we are as a society. There's a power yoga, and there's the hot yoga, and then
right.
There are all of those sort of things. And those may burn a few more calories. It kind of, the purpose of yoga isn't to burn calories so much as it is, because you're not going to really raise your heart rate. You're really trying to stretch, lengthen, meditate, improve the body in a more gentle form, except for those power forms of yoga.
Kristen has another thought about exercise. Kristen, calling us from Towson, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was just calling to make a comment about the psychological effects of exercise, and this kind of goes right in with the discussion about yoga. I am a high school teacher, and I do high-intensity interval training and kettlebell training about 4 to 5 times a week. And I didn't start off there. I mean, I certainly, like, started with the walking and moving forward, you know. But I think one of the biggest benefits for me is, yes, I've gained strength. Yes, there have been times when I've lost weight, and, you know, that's been great too. But I feel like the sense of accomplishment that I get every time I go and I take a class, you know, as I think in our society, there are a lot of days when you feel like you're just running on a hamster wheel and you're not getting anything done. And when you go and you put in however much time it is, whether it's 15 minutes to an hour or whatever, that sense of, okay, I did this, it's something that you can sort of check off your list. I think that that's one of the most beneficial things to exercise. And it's one of the things that people don't really talk about a whole lot because they care more about, like, well, will it make me stronger? How will it make me look different?
Kristen, I appreciate your raising this. Joe Zimmerman, you're nodding your head vigorously as you're listening to Kristen.
I think the personal training groups do not do enough to help personal trainers understand the mental health benefits of regular exercise. And so, Kristen, hooray for you. Thank you for bringing it up. One of the groups of regular exercisers who are noted for being most consistent and most successful in keeping their routine are early morning exercisers. I am not one of them. I don't like exercising in the morning. But those are the folks that get it done in the morning. And if you think about it, the first thing on their list, check off the list.
They've done it.
They've taken care of themselves. I mean, you could roll out of bed with your hair on sideways, roll into the gym. Nobody cares what you look like because they're not paying attention to anything. I've worked that morning shift. And you get it done, and you get in the shower, and you get dressed in your beautiful work clothes, and you have this marvelous feeling of accomplishment or superiority or success or satisfaction. And you have a clear head, and you haven't got to jack your body up at the rest of the day. If you're tired at the end of the day, you can go home and sit down. Brilliant. Brilliant.
But it's not you.
I'm not. I'm an afternoon or evening exerciser. Some people find that it keeps them up in the evening if they exercise late in the day. You got to do what works.
And on that note, we're going to take another quick break here. When we come back, another longstanding debate about stretching. Is it a must before or after working out? Does stretching guard against injury? Lots more to talk about, and you can be part of this conversation. Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Joe Zimmerman, physical activity program coordinator and lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. We're talking about the merits beyond potential weight loss of exercise. Do you ever take up a fitness routine and then get bored after a few workouts? How do you shake things up? How do you keep yourself going with a fitness routine? Have you always been diligent about working out, or are you just starting out? What motivates you to exercise? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Matt has phoned us from Baltimore. Matt, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
No, I'm doing pretty well. I guess my comments, a couple things. I was calling primarily just as far as weightlifting. So I've been doing weight training for, I guess, about 3 years now, and I've recently added running and yoga to it to get a more complete thing. And I was wondering kind of your thoughts as far as weight training for older people, you know, as far as once they, you know, to maintain their metabolism and to stay healthy as they age.
I love weight training for people who can pick up weights. That everybody from about age 8 to when they can't pick them up anymore. I think it's a great plan. So I'm all for it. I do appreciate that you threw in some running and some yoga. You do need that three-dimensional approach to your health and your fitness. And I like how you phrase that, to maintain the metabolism. You're going to have to try to hang on to some muscle mass as you age. One of my fitness heroes, and he's been gone for a couple of years now, was Jack LaLanne. If you break out your Googler and have a look. Jack LaLanne was one of the people who got people in general moving, but especially women moving, and got women to lift weights. And he was an advocate for weightlifting as an exercise practice, and not necessarily that everybody had to turn themselves into a bodybuilder, a power lifter, any such thing, but that it was good for you. And, you know, he was incredibly right. Even the guy who invented aerobics, Dr. Ken Cooper, is a strong proponent of weight training and weightlifting now. So what it does is it helps you maintain your muscles. To a certain degree, you don't get to hang on to all of it as you age. You get to be 60 or 70 years of age. You just don't get to hang on to all of it. But if you keep lifting weights and you keep mixing it up every now and then, and it doesn't mean you have to mix it up every day, but you mix it up every now and then, every 6 weeks or so, you're giving a signal to your body that, hey, I like this stuff. I want to hang on to it. So if you're going to go scavenge for calories, if you want to lose some weight, go somewhere else, right? And particularly the advantage for women to lift weights is that as you are lifting weights, the muscles are pulling on the bones, and that sends a signal to the bones, hey, we like you. Why don't you stay put and stay strong as well? So often, middle-aged women, a little bit younger and on into older years, need to begin to lift weights, and you can really challenge yourself. It can be difficult to put on a lot of muscle, even if that's your goal, but you can definitely get stronger throughout the lifespan. I think it's a great idea.
Matt, thanks for the question. Heath has called us from West Virginia with, I think, a question about aging. Heath, welcome to Midday. We may have lost.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Heath.
Yeah, hi. Look, I'm very keen on the on the benefits and the praises of exercise, but I'm equally as curious of the centennials you often run into or hear of, who claim that they've never exercised as much as an hour in their entire lives, and they're turning 105 and so on. So what do they do that the rest of us don't?
Okay, Heath, I appreciate the question. Anybody who's at 105 is an outlier in some way anyway, but what response would you make?
Well, the 80 and older age group is one of the fastest growing groups in our population, and we would like there to be lots of lovely old people as long as they're well and they want to be well. So I would encourage people to exercise safely. You may need to check with your doctor, of course, but there's a lot that older people can do. But yeah, there's just luck. People, if you think about people who are 100 years old now, lived through the Depression and lived through World War II with food deprivations and rationing.
Well, they were infants during World War I.
And they were infants during World War I with food rations. So these are people who are extraordinary in a lot of ways. And then they survived before we had penicillin and all kinds of incredible things. You know, this is one of those, and forgive me, my English teacher's going to roll over in her grave. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Mm-hmm. Leave them alone. Let them do what they're doing. You're 106, keep walking. But most of the time, if you're going to try to get old, you're going to need to do some physical activity to take care of yourself.
We got an email from Jane who says, 4 years ago, I suffered a hernia which nearly killed me because I did not recognize the symptoms. By the time I presented myself to the emergency room, I was suffering blood poisoning with a side order of broken heart syndrome, heart attack. After surgery, my doctor told me that what had saved my life were the facts that I neither smoke nor drink and that I do a lot of walking. Needless to say, I still walk often, if not every day.
Wow. Wow. Well, I can't argue with not smoking. The phrase I use with my students is it's a bad idea to set something on fire and put it in your face. And I don't know that most other forms of tobacco consumption have any merits either. So as a category, that's probably a good behavior to avoid, any kind of tobacco use. Drinking, there's evidence that for some people, drinking in moderation, assuming you're old enough, has some benefits, the whole red wine thing in France and all of that. But not everybody wants to drink, and certainly it comes with some calories that may be counterproductive to someone's goals. But the business about her recovery and her resilience to a pretty big health insult, yeah, if you're healthier, you're a regular exerciser, you've taken good care of yourself, your vascular plumbing is in good shape, your enzymes for energy consumption are in good shape, your bones, your lungs, your heart, all of that's in good shape. If you're then going to take some kind of hit, like a blood poisoning and a hernia or any kind of major body issue, you've got a better chance at surviving it and you've got a better chance at recovery. It doesn't mean it's going to prevent it, but it does enhance your chances of success afterward.
Marcia has called us from Cockeysville. Marcia, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I wanted to put in a plug for gardening. I do exercise. I do yoga and walking and weightlifting, and I do that to keep in good health and so I can garden. And I have a lot of friends who are gardeners, and they're all in good shape. So I know not everybody can do it, but it really works. All the muscle masses in different parts of the body, you know, squatting, pulling, pushing, shoveling, raking, and I just think it's one of the best exercises that one can get.
Thank you, Marcia, for that suggestion. It sounds wonderful in the same way that I think of yoga. And a few minutes ago, you were saying yoga is great, but it really isn't part of the 2.5 hours of exercise that would count as moderate exercise by the CDC. Do you feel the same way about gardening, or is gardening more of a physical challenge?
I think it varies more than yoga. I think there are the gardeners who have the sort of victory garden kind of backyard planting, you know, with the raised beds and all of that. And it's a lot of physical work. And when it's a lot of physical work, it counts. Absolutely, it counts. If you can pick up a 40-pound bag of compost and you're a 5-foot-1-inch, 112-pound woman, you're doing something. You're hauling that stuff around. The bending relates to flexibility, the loading, the hand and body control to reach for weeding behind the, you know, the big tomato plants or whatever. I'm picturing my father's garden. You know, all of that can count. But if you've got a little herb box on your garden windows or your windowsill in your kitchen, that's not gardening. And you're snipping a couple of pieces of basil for your salad is probably not going to get it done. So I think the spectrum, vigorous gardening, vigorous is the word. Vigorous gardening, I think that counts for sure.
And is that something that your Fitbit would pick up if you were counting on gardening?
You know,
what's a good way to test whether or not it's doing for
you?
Oh,
they measure that kind of thing. There's a whole compendium. Dr. Barbara Ainsworth has a whole compendium of all these physical activities, and all these things have different merits and values. We measure that with an instrument called an accelerometer. A Fitbit is a minor version, but mostly Fitbits measure impacts like a pedometer. So gardening with the bending and the lifting might not register on a Fitbit, but if you do a fair amount of it and you're puttering around in a physically small space but you're working hard, you might be able to enter it manually with one of the online programs that you can integrate with these appliances.
By the way, we got an email from Alex who wants to let us know about an affordable fitness tracker he got for his second grade son who really wanted a watch activity tracker. The brand is CopperFit. I got it at Walgreens for $20. For $20, it's no frills, no app or syncing, but it works fine for our purposes. By the way, I told my son that it's fine to keep track of his activity, but if he starts obsessing, I'll take away the tracker. He's a very active 8-year-old who eats well, and I don't want him putting too much emphasis on exercising at this point in his life. Is that a risk?
Yeah, it's you got to find the right balance, and kids will go through phases like that, as will adults to a lesser degree. He'll get a little over fascinated, and then the novelty will wear off, and it'll balance itself back out, I think. But you do have to guard against that. You don't want to be, you know, 1,000 steps short on your you know, self-assigned goal and at 11:45 at night go jogging around the block in your pajamas. That is silly. That is obsessive and probably not healthy. Give yourself a day off. Give yourself a pat on the back for trying tomorrow. You can always start fresh the next day.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who raised a question about what types of exercise would you recommend for people who are missing limbs due to amputation. He didn't say what limbs, and I would imagine the exercise might depend on that. But do you have some general advice?
Actually, that's an excellent question because, you know, it's so easy to assume that everybody can just go out and walk and do, you know, any old thing. But there is a whole specialty called adapted physical activity or adapted physical education when it's in schools. And this is to help people who have non-ordinary bodies. Maybe they have cerebral palsy, or maybe they have had amputation, or maybe they have mental development challenges. And there are lots of ways to get people moving that is going to be very specific to their condition. For someone who has a lower limb amputation, that might be developing a way to do a program with a prosthetic or by getting into the pool. Depending on what's available. If for someone who is a wheelchair user, the upper body exercise, has a little different value, but that's what the person's capable of. Again, if someone's a beginner in a fully ordinary body, you do something at the beginning. If someone has a less or other than ordinary body, I want to be disrespectful, something with who's, you know, maybe non-standard issued equipment, you adapt. But it's okay to exercise, and there are ways to figure it out.
How soon after you, we're down to just a minute or so, but I'm curious about how soon after you stop exercising do you start to lose the benefit? I mean, this isn't something you can bank. This isn't something that if you've been a wonderful exerciser, you can take a decade off.
It's so reversible. The aerobic benefits, meaning your wind, your breathing, your heart, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You know, if you have a case of the flu or a very bad cold and your lungs are, you know, a little impaired for a while, you're going to suffer within some degree within 3 days, 2 to 3 days. But you can pick back up relatively quickly after you recover. And you may have to pace yourself back, take maybe 10 or 15% off of your workout if you've been down 2 or 3, 4 days. Maybe take it down 25% if you've been out for a week. Start back, drop back a little bit and work your way back up. The strengthening exercise, you can probably hang on for outright strength, raw strength, absolute strength, for maybe 4 to 6 weeks, but you don't keep your muscular endurance. In other words, you can lift it once, but you can't lift it 12 times. But again, that is dynamic and will come back when you get back to regular training.
But it fades pretty fast. Yeah. You got to keep this going.
Yeah, you can't just exercise once. That's why the 2.5 hours on the weekend doesn't get it done. It really is better to do a little bit most days of the week, 2 or 3, 4 times a week. Go for it.
Joe Zimmerman, I really appreciate this conversation. It's been fun talking to you.
Your listeners are asking great questions, too, by the way.
We have great listeners.
Yes.
Joe Zimmerman is Physical Activity Program Coordinator and Lecturer in the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Maryland. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches, salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. There are now 31 confirmed cases of Zika in Maryland, all contracted in other countries. How worried should we be? I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.